So I'm happy to be concluding yet another beautiful Share Festival. And I will always do whatever I can to help Torino do this wonderful thing. So today I'd like to talk a little bit about mistakes in the development of media and in technology more generally, and what role mistakes play there. So I've brought you some really ugly graphics that suits the topic. Here's the Tower of Babel in North Korea. You see nothing. No Tower of Babel. Okay, we got one great technical mistake. There we go. This is a great kind of contemporary signal of technological failure. This is a hotel which was built in Pyongyang by the North Korean regime. And it was never completed. So it's what the Brazilians call an esqueleto, or skeleton building, in that the outer structure was built, but it never was filled in. And it died before it was born. It's a kind of stillborn ruin. And, you know, why did the North Korean regime decide to build this thing? Well, it was supposed to be a hotel. It's supposed to be full of tourists who, for some imaginary reason, would want to go to Pyongyang. And they have never managed, and they also did it in order to humiliate the South Koreans, because they were aware that the South Koreans had a more functional economic system, so they wanted to build this sort of signature ultimate totalitarian building in order to frighten and impress the neighbors. But they never completed the building, and they're still working on it sometimes, but people who've gone by it say it will never be built. It was not properly designed in the beginning, and it doesn't work at all, and the interior heating and vacuuming and air conditioning and the elevators are not going to work in this structure. And so it's just a kind of gigantic techno monster. And, you know, what is good about this legendary skeleton is that it makes the rest of us smarter. Like, it's camp, right? It's a campy structure. It's a lie that tells the truth. And the lie is, well, in North Korea, we can build the biggest hotel in Asia for a horde of tourists. And the truth is, there are no tourists, and it's not the biggest hotel in Asia. And I'm sure that if you're a Korean and you go to your capital city and you see this building, which is the biggest building in the capital city, it must have some kind of strong moral message for you. It must be telling you something about your own society, like, we would like to be super large and high-tech and impressive, but in fact, we're just a failing totalitarian regime and we can't really do this. So in a way, they spent a great deal of money and tremendous human effort to build a political symbol that is perfectly clear to everybody else. And I think a lot of our technologies serve this purpose, actually. Now, and how do we know that? Well, there are certain things we know already that are about the mistakes that we make in thinking about technology. And I want to describe a few of these. Number one is the famous Gartner hype cycle. And Gartner are a group of futurists. They're a corporation, a group who advises corporations. They are business futurists. And in the Gartner hype cycle, there is a description of how the population reacts to technological novelty. And at the beginning, there's always a period of hype, according to the Gartner hype cycle. And hype means exaggerated expectations of how important this new thing will be. So when we're presented with something new, there are a great many people who attempt to publicize it and build public excitement about it. And the hype is always followed by what Gartner calls the trough of disillusionment. And in the trough of disillusionment, you go up the slope of the hype and then you fall down it and you think, it's not like they said it was, and they sold me this thing and I thought it was great and it only sort of works, and look, there's all these problems with it and it malfunctions in these other ways and so forth. And then there's what Gartner calls the slope of enlightenment. Well, you learn what this new thing is really good for, and it's not usually the thing that you were told it was good for in the hype. It has some practical purpose and it's good for something. And then you reach the plateau of practical development where you just use it every day and you forget that it was even new ever. And you probably don't remember where it came from, and you've forgotten all about the hype, and now it's just some object in your environment, and you just give up sort of thinking about it. It's just there for you. So this cycle, which could be mapped onto many, many objects, suggests that we always believe too much of a young technology, and we always become disillusioned with it. And eventually we just come to accept it as part of our lives. And that's very human, because that's exactly what we think about ourselves and our children. Like, you have a baby. It's like, I've had a baby. Maybe my baby will be the prime minister. Look at my baby. My baby is the most beautiful baby any woman has ever had. I can't believe how cute this baby is. This baby must be a genius. Maybe my son will be Pope someday, you know, and maybe he will, you know, but probably he'll just go to school and, you know, maybe he'll become a petty criminal, but maybe he graduates, you know, and then he like marries somebody. It's like, my daughter-in-law, she's going to be the most beautiful daughter-in-law in the world. Look at my son marrying this beautiful girl. She's going to make him so happy. Look how much in love they are. They're doting on each other. They can't keep their hands off each other, you know, and then they actually get married, and the son comes by and he's crying. You know, I knew she was German when I married her, but I didn't. Mom, I never knew she was really German. Mom, my wife is really, really German. What have I done, you know? Now she's pregnant, we're having a child. Okay, this is the trough of disillusionment. You know, and then at the end you like learn, okay, she's German, but you know, if you're nice to her, it's like, okay, there's like certain places she can't go, but I can manage with that, and I've been married to her for a while, and I kind of like understand her quirks. I mean, she's human like the rest of us. Maybe she's not a goddess, you know, I didn't marry Carla Bruni. But, you know, this is my spouse here, and it's okay, and, you know, all right, and it's like, then you're sort of growing old, and you forget you were never, ever married to her. It's like, she's always been there somehow. She's just, like, there for you. She's part of your family. You know, okay, that's how we react, right? That's a human reaction, and that's not a mistake. I mean, in some sense, it's a mistake, but also it's just part of the kind of great human story. Now, even if you know that these things are true, and you know that new objects and services will appear in the world, that doesn't necessarily mean that your foresight helps you. Because there's another very important book by an author named Clayton Christensen, who is a professor of business at MIT. And this book is called The Innovator's Dilemma. And the Innovator's Dilemma is all about what you do if you're, for instance, Kodak, the camera company, and somebody brings you a digital camera. Now, I happen to know a little bit about Kodak because I've like talked to people there. I kind of hate to pick on them, but I know why they failed. The people at Kodak were extremely good American engineers, and they knew that digital cameras would replace analog cameras eventually, because there's no film, right? And you just take all the pictures you want, and there's lots of room to store things. And at first they were pretty bad cameras, but they knew that there would be a big transition from analog to digital. The problem was they had the innovator's dilemma, which was that they could not destroy the business they already had, which was built around processing film, and replace it successfully with a business that was killing their earlier business. There was just no way for them to make that pay. And they furthermore made a number of other mistakes by trying to build digital cameras that were as good as their analog cameras, because they thought they made good cameras, and they thought cameras had to be good. They didn't realize that people would happily pay for really bad pictures, because they'd spent their entire career trying to make film better and better, and cameras better and better. And it was completely counterintuitive to tell them, well, you have to make really bad cameras that are really cheap cameras. So they never succeeded in replacing their business with the business that followed it, even though they were extremely good engineers, they were keenly aware of how to do it, they had the capacity to build the best cameras, they had the money to build the best cameras, they had a distribution system that could have distributed the cameras everywhere. They just could not move away from the old way of doing things and adapt to a new one and survive the transition. This is related to the favorite cyberpunk dictum that William Gibson made up, the famous term, the street finds its own uses for things, which is kind of the bohemian version of this. It's like, hi, I'm a hippie, and I'm not in business. And I don't care if you're Kodak or not. Just give me the gizmo, and I'll do whatever I want with it, right? Just kind of an aggressive, subversive, interventionist style approach, which is extremely common in the electronic arts and many other places. But it's basically making the same statement as the Gartner hype cycle and the innovator's dilemma, which says, okay, you're very excited about this, but in the long run, that's not what it's really about. It's really about what the street says it's about, or it's really about what the investor says it's about, or it's really about what my friends say it's about, or it's really just a failure of your, on your part, like the North Korean thing, and now everybody knows how badly off you are. So, let's talk a little bit about the subject of mistakes. Now, why is it that we're making these errors? Well, you know, they are errors, but they're sort of errors in historical retrospect. And they're necessary errors in some ways. They're just ingrained in the way we see the world. So there's a very good book on this subject, which is called The Design of Everyday Things by Donald Norman. Donald Norman is a design critic. He's one of the meanest design critics in the world. When this guy tears into designers, they go pale and they tremble with fear because Donald Norman has terrible things to say about design. But the reason Donald Norman criticizes designers and criticizes objects and services is because Donald Norman is a cognitive psychologist. And he studies the way the human brain actually works when we interact with goods and services. And the fact is that we have inbuilt glitches in our heads. There are just certain mistakes that the human brain makes, which are very common. And they're like stumbling while you walk, or letting something slip out of your hands, or having insomnia at night. We're just not perfectly rational, and we don't understand things perfectly at all times. And he classifies some of these structures of mistakes. And I'm going to try to describe them now. And I think you will recognize that you make these mistakes all the time, like several times a day, in fact. And they're just plain glitches. I mean, they're glitches in your head, the way that like my screen going black here is a glitch. Okay, first part. This is called captive errors. And captive errors are when you're trying to do two different things, two different little series of objects, and you do one of them a lot, and the other one is slightly different. So you get into the habit of doing it the one way, and then you have to do it the other way, just one time out of 10. But since you're so well trained in doing it the first way, that habit captures this other thing you're trying to do. For instance, you know, you're trying to get upstairs and you're trying to go through your door and you have two locks on your door. And this day you left and you decided not to lock the outer door because you were just going out for some milk, and why would I lock both my doors? So you go out and you get the milk and you bring it back and you come to the front door, which you left unlocked, but then you lock it because you just put the key in there. Because you're used to unlocking it, right? You're like, of course, every day you have to unlock the door. And then, but this day you didn't leave it unlocked, and you don't remember, right? I mean, you're in the habit of doing it. So the routine of doing the lock captures this other routine of not having the lock. And in fact, you lock yourself out of the house. Instead of going in, you know, so you're standing there and you're thinking, why did I do this crazy thing? Okay, you're programmed to do it. That's called a capture error. And it's just part of the way that your body and your mind react to the world. And it doesn't have anything to do with your being absent-minded or stupid or bad. That's just like breathing. You know, it's just a part of the human psyche. That's a capture error. A description error. In a description error, there are two things in your environment that look kind of the same. Like, say, there's a little pitcher of orange juice, and there's a little pitcher of crema. And it's the morning, and you like pour some coffee, and you're like looking at the newspaper, and you reach out and you take your pitcher of orange juice and you put it into your coffee. That's a description error, right? Because they're two little pitchers, and they both have liquid in them, and they look kind of the same, and your coffee's in there, and every morning you put some cream in your coffee, and this morning you put the orange juice into your coffee. It's like, have I lost my mind? Look, I've spoiled my coffee with my orange juice. No, you've just fallen for a description error because you mistook the one for the other. They look the same, they function the same. Your brain was not able to make that distinction, and your hand just sort of went out and semi-automatically did this, and you made a mistake. Then there's the data-driven error. Data-driven errors come from reading something in the environment and trying to do something. Like, for instance, suppose you're trying to dial a phone number on your telefonino, and it's 323-5686. So you're going, okay, 323-5686, and if somebody then shouts 7, somebody in the room, 7, 7, 7, you will dial 7, 7, right? Because you're like there concentrating on these numbers, and then another number hits your ear, or you're typing away. Somebody says milk, and you write the word milk. Because it's just, you know, it hit your ear. I mean, you're trying to copy something. Some other piece of data comes out of the environment. It inserts itself into this process that you're doing. That's a data-driven error. You are paying attention. Probably a lot of attention. You're really concentrating. You're like 3, 2, 3, 5, 6, 8, 8, 8, right? You can't help that any more than like a computer catching a virus. There's very little you can do about a thing like that. It's part of the way that the human brain and body interact with the world. You would call yourself absent-minded, but it's just a glitch. I mean, it's the thing that's inbuilt into our cognition. That's part of the human psyche. And then there's the associative error. And the associative error is basically just what we call absent-mindedness. You're thinking of something really kind of more interesting than the thing you're doing right now. Like, you're thinking about your boyfriend, and you know, you're also trying to bathe your dog, and you kiss the dog. Now, normally you don't kiss the dog, but you know, you were thinking about the boyfriend and you have this sudden gush of affection, and like the dog is there, and it's like you're washing the dog and he's like there in the bathtub where the boyfriend was. It's like, I love your dog, you know? You know, and you can't, I mean, maybe you don't love the dog, but you know, you're just like swept away. I mean, you're not, to do the dog is a chore, and to think about your boyfriend is kind of a great pleasure, and you just like got carried away with this other train of thought, and you know, the dog was kind of there and the boyfriend is not there, and you just, you know, you just what the heck? You know, I mean, you just sort of kiss the dog, and now you feel slightly, but why did I kiss the dog? Okay, I like the dog well enough. I didn't, like, kill myself by kissing it, but I did, in fact, kiss the dog. And that was an associative error. I was actually daydreaming about something that meant something more to me, that sort of captured my attention in some other way, and I lost my grip on what I was doing, and I committed this error, and people do this all the time. There's no reason not to do this. So Donald Norman, as a design critic, goes around looking at things and pointing out how easy it would be to make one of these various kinds of psychological errors in reacting to these things. And people do make the errors, and then they blame themselves, often very bitterly. It's like, oh, you know, I picked up the wrong remote control, and I, like, aimed it at the television, and now, like, I've messed up all my channels, and I can't find where I was, and it's all my fault. Boy, am I stupid. Actually, no. You were victimized by a system that wasn't built with, like, undo things. It should have been more user-friendly and should have allowed you to retrace these very, very common cognitive errors with less trouble. Now, there is a school of design which is specifically made to combat this. And it was created by the automobile industry, Japanese automobile industry, in order to reduce errors on assembly lines. And this is called Poka Yoke. It's Japanese. Invented by a guy named Shingeo Shingo. He's an engineer. So what Shingeo did was he stood at the end of the assembly line, just making notes of all the mistakes people had made. And they always make some. I mean, they make cognitive errors, descriptive errors, data-driven errors, and associative errors, especially on Monday. They're just thinking about what they did, and, you know, they're not really able to concentrate. So he would go, and he would just look at the end of the thing, and he would look at all the parts that were broken. And then he would go in, and he would try to replace the part of the system where the error had occurred by making the error impossible. For instance, there's a part that was installed upside down. Okay, he would then redesign the parts that it was physically impossible to turn it upside down. Just, you can't do it that way. And if you look at the way IKEA furniture is designed, you'll see a beautiful example of Poka Yoke. I mean, again and again, they're like trying to make it impossible for you to make a stupid quote-unquote error. They won't let you have anything sharp. They won't let you have anything dangerous. Everything is pretty much the same size. If it's not the same size, it won't fit in there. There are all kinds of little cues on the object and the surface, so you can put it together. That's Poka Yoke design. It's why IKEA is making millions and millions of dollars and slowly taking over the world. It's by reducing the possibility of these cognitive errors among people assembling IKEA furniture. And, you know, and it's still hard to do. But it gets better. Because they sit there and they watch people bring in broken IKEA furniture, and they say, okay, well, she broke it that way, and we're going to, like, turn it around so it's, like, impossible to break it that way. So there's some advantages to living in a Poka Yoke universe, especially if you only have to do it once. But the problem with a Poka Yoke design is that it really stupefies people by reducing their ability to make mistakes, and it makes work much more boring, just much more troublesome to do, because you have no power to affect what's going on, and basically anything you could do to change the situation has been engineered away so that you can't ever do anything except perfectly, and this has a tough effect on people. It's just difficult to deal with. And, you know, what's the motto of this particular part of the speech? Don't blame yourself is the motto, because people will blame themselves for mishandling objects which cause them to undergo these very simple errors. And the truth is that millions and millions and millions of human beings are always committing these errors. It's the way we are built. We can't manage the world with perfect cognition any more than we can walk across the world without ever stumbling or slipping on our feet. We don't walk perfectly, we don't blame ourselves for that. I mean, if you slip in the street, okay, I slipped. It's not the, I can't blame the myself for badly interacting with the sidewalk. It's just a a question of probability. Everybody commits these errors. You're going to commit them sooner or later. Sometimes they can have really severe effects, and you bring them on yourself when, in fact, it would be better if the thing had been designed to reduce those kinds of errors, or at least to enable you to get past that particular mistake. So, see how we're doing here. Oh, yeah. Quite enjoying this. Now I'm going to tell you some Siegfried Zielinski-style gizmo stories. And, you know, and this is about my idea of techno development here. Okay, well, let's just... I want you to look at these objects. Okay, and I've got pictures of their inventors as well. I might as well load those up. Where did my other inventor go? Nope, not him. There he is. Okay, these men were born at the same time, and they were more or less in the same business, and they all more or less knew one another. And these are the objects they made. There's like this object here, and then there's this object here, which actually looks a heck of a lot like this object here. And then there's this object here, which doesn't actually work very well unless it's connected to a telephone switchboard, which looks a heck of a lot like this object. So this is a device which is connected to an object that looks sort of like this, except we're not seeing this. So this is Alexander Graham Bell, the inventor of the telephone, and he's young, and this is his early telephone. And this is Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens, very famous American novelist. And this is Thaddeus Cahill, Dr. Thaddeus Cahill, perfecter of the teleharmonium. Now, these men had some relationship. I mean, everything's related to the telephone. Like, even this thing is impossible without a telephone. You couldn't dwell in a building like this unless there are telephones in every room, because how would you get in and get out? You'd have to, like, send messenger boys rushing up and down 70. It would be impossible. So the telephone actually made skyscrapers possible. But the telephone also made this device possible. And this is the Cahill teleharmonium. And this device is called the Page Compositor. And this gentleman was a customer of this gentleman. Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens, was one of the first persons to actually use the Cahill teleharmonium. So what interests me as a student of tech development is there any way that you could tell which one of these three guys made a terrible mistake? I mean, everybody knows that Alexander Graham Bell supposedly invented the telephone, and we've all got telephones, so it's hard to believe that Alexander Graham Bell made a mistake. But is this device a mistake, and is this device a mistake? And was there any way at the time to know that the guys were making a mistake? I mean, which one of these was the mistake? And it's kind of a historical puzzle, because to us, they're just sort of large, intricate pieces of inventive machinery, and they don't look like anything we make nowadays. And how could we know if there were mistakes or not? Or maybe they were inevitable mistakes. Because here we have a book by a colleague of mine, which I'm reading right now, What Technology Wants by Kevin Kelly, famous American journalist and tech thinker. And in this new book of Kevin's, Kevin is trying to determine whether technology has an inbuilt direction, whether it's inevitable that certain things will happen in technological development. And he argues that it does. In fact, he argues that there's something called exotropic vortices to which technology is sort of chaotically attracted. And they're kind of like technical whirlpools of possibility where people sort of naturally drift and where people cluster and where they work together. And, you know, maybe that's not a very plausible way to put it, because exotropic isn't a word in English. It's just the word Kevin made up. And it's certainly not a word in Italian. And what is a vortex? And how could you tell whether something was a vortex or not? But he doesn't really have any other way to put it. and actually a pretty good example of an exotropic vortex from Kevin's point of view would be Share Festival. Because, you know, here you've got a lot of people who are all trying to do something, and they don't really know whether it's really good or really just sort of weird. And they all kind of get to know one another, and they probably know one another pretty well, and they're sort of working on the same thing, but it's sort of hard to describe what they're doing exactly. And maybe this artwork is just something kind of silly, or maybe this will turn out to be an extremely inventive thing that will like be legendary 20 years from now. And it's like, oh my goodness, what a breakthrough on the ground. And so there's just kind of a vortex of human energy and people sharing ideas and techniques. So one of the things Kevin argues about is, in fact, this guy's telephone. Now, we all know that Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone, unless we're Italian, in which case we probably know that Antonio Meucci invented the telephone. And who was this guy? Well, he was an Italian engineer, Risorgimento guy, Meucci. Very good friend of Garibaldi. People sometimes know Garibaldi like left Italy and was working in the United States at a candle factory. Meucci owned the candle factory. He was actually Garibaldi's employer. And he did, in fact, build something like a telephone, mostly because of a personal tragedy. His wife had very bad arthritis. She was sick and couldn't leave the bed. So Meucci, who knew a little bit about electricity, put a tin plate on the end of a cable and then strung the electrical cable downstairs to his office and put another tin plate there. So that when his wife yelled at the tin plate, a current would go through the cable and there would be a noise in his office. And he would know, well, my wife can't get out of bed, I'd better go take her some food or whatever it was that she wanted. So in his reaction to this personal tragedy of a crippled wife, Meucci invented a device, an electrical device that carried voice noises through his house. And if you're Italian, you can argue this is a telephone, because why isn't it a telephone? It's got a copper cable, and there's like a woman yelling, and you're going to help her, right? So he patented this thing, but he couldn't find anybody to invest in it, because he was too busy fighting the Risorgimento, and most of Italy was on fire, and nobody really wanted to know about telephones, because, you know, the thousand were invading Sicily and every kind of hell was breaking loose, and, you know, and he was very involved in that. And then later he was on board an American steamboat and it blew up and he was crippled by the exploding ships. And now there's two crippled people. There's like the crippled wife and the crippled engineer, and he's broke and his country's on fire and so forth. So, you know, he was almost in the running for the inventor of the telephone. And in fact, as soon as Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone, literally hundreds of inventors of the telephone appeared. He had to fight 600 lawsuits against different people saying, "You invented the telephone. Heck no, it was really me. Why, you fraud. Under no circumstances. Alexander Graham Bell, you dog. You've stolen my brilliant idea. Look, I too had copper cables." You know, and this went on for 17 years. And he won every lawsuit. Bell won all these lawsuits. So, you know, there were 600 attempts to prove that he had not invented the telephone, and he in fact invented the telephone, but he didn't invent anything else that ever worked, mostly because he was really busy proving lawsuits, but also because a lot of his other ideas were really crazy. Just nutty ideas. I mean, wild inventions like flying machines and a kind of personal astrophysics in which gravity didn't exist. Bell really thought that gravity did not exist. In other words, what really mattered was that everything is pushed together and it only feels like gravity is pushing us as a kind of universal pressure. And he was like working on this for years and years, this kind of personal system of physics where there is no attraction, there's only a universal repulsion. We're actually being pushed down under the center of the earth. So, you know, here's a guy who's basically a crank figure. I mean, he basically acts more like an electronic artist an electrical designer or engineer. He's just a guy with a lot of weird ideas. And one of them happens to be the telephone. All right. So he's the success among the three. So who is this? Well, this is a novelist, Twain. And this is Twain's device, the page compositor. Now, Twain very liked inventors and technology. He was an American of his period. And he had also worked briefly in the printing business as a young man. And when he became rich and famous, he found an inventor, a guy named Page, who had invented this device, which is an automatic typesetting machine. And he went and he demonstrated the automatic typesetting machine to Twain. And Twain believed it would work. And in fact, it would have worked, but he just wasn't a very good investor. So he lost all his money. He went almost bankrupt. He had to sell his all his possessions. And he left the United States and lived in Europe for 7 years, basically touring and lecturing and writing travel books in an attempt to make up for his desperately failed effort to become a media mogul. Because he actually planned to put these devices in every newspaper and every magazine in the United States and around the world. Because nobody had ever built an automatic typesetting machine. They were all done by hand. It was very laborious and very slow. And he realized that if he could automate this, he would make millions and millions of dollars. He was correct. It was automated, but it was automated by the Morgenthaler Linotype rather than the Page compositor. And the Morgenthaler Linotype, in fact, made hundreds of millions of dollars and was an extremely successful technical invention. But Twain was a little bit late to market, and his machine was more complicated than the Linotype, and he didn't know how to promote it properly or really how to engineer it. So he failed, and he actually went bankrupt in his attempt to become a media mogul. Now this guy, the beloved of Siegfried Zielinski and myself, Dr. Thaddeus Cahill, is the inventor of this device, which is called the Cahill Teleharmonium. And this is the first electronic music device ever built. And it was specifically designed to play music over telephone lines. It was a telephone, electronic music telephone playing service. And it has a keyboard here, and this chair is where the performer sits. And you buy a special iPod-like speaker, and you plug it into your telephone, and you like turn on your Cahill Teleharmonium service, and electronic organ music starts coming out of your telephone. And you can sort of have as much as you want, and it's like a flat rate fee, and there's like somebody sitting there. It's right next to the telephone switching station, which is Bell's telephone station. So it's basically a Bell peripheral. But it's streamed electronic music with a flat rate subscription service. One of the first guys to buy it, Mark Twain, had it in his house. There's many eyewitness accounts, people going into Twain's house, it's like, where is that strange music? Never have I heard such enchanting music coming from the wall, and why there is no musician here. And, you know, and of course, radio has not been invented yet. It's the record player has not been invented. And there's not even like a Victrola or a dictaphone. It's like the only way to get music without human intervention by, you know, kind of strange Stellarkian cosmic connection to disconnected music. Okay, we may say, all right, this wasn't a very good idea. But in fact, it was Bell's original idea. When Bell first went around with his device trying to show that the telephone was useful, his comrade, Mr. Watson, would go into another room and play on an organ. And that's what people would hear. And it's like, I can't believe it. There was music coming out of that box. You know, and nobody had ever heard music come out of a box. And this was what Bell thought was the business model for his object. I mean, yes, sometimes people might talk to one another, but obviously it would be much more profitable to be an entertainment mogul with my telephone. It's just like, and I have the central switching station, and I can reach everybody all at once. Why should I connect one person to one person when I could just like talk to 100,000 subscribers all at the same time? Right? So, you know, this sounds a bit far-fetched. I mean, it doesn't sound far-fetched to us, but the question I want to know is, was that a mistake? Was it actually a mistake? I mean, did Cahill commit a mistake when he thought that he could, like, do streaming live electronic music before the Victrola was invented? Now, there are good reasons to argue that it wasn't a mistake. That was actually an extremely plausible idea. For instance, the first time the telephone became really famous was due to an accident. This was the famous Tariffville, Connecticut disaster of January 1878. And at this point, there were just a few cities that had telephones installed because they were expensive and you had to put wire in the middle of the street and people would walk by and say, why are there wires up in the air? I don't want this. And when they barely worked, and they were only available to wealthy people, such as lawyers, doctors, and bankers. So the telephone was basically a bizarre device that allowed people to talk, and it was a way for sort of rich people to impose their will on other people. I mean, only the rich people had telephones. These were the users, and they were stringing wire all over the town and making the town seem ugly. And it's just a strange high-tech toy, and why are we doing this? And there was a certain amount of reaction against it. I mean, it was spreading, but it was spreading slowly. But then in January 1878, there was a religious meeting, and a train load of people went off to see a famous preacher, a guy named Dr. Moody. So they all went to see Dr. Moody in the middle of the winter, big crowd of Americans, eager to enjoy a little religious fundamentalism. And they went and they saw this guy, and then they were returning home in the middle of the night on their heavily laden train of holy Americans, and the bridge collapsed. The bridge collapsed, and the train full of evangelists fell into the frozen river. And 30 people were crushed, and 30 people were injured, and there were children freezing in the broken ice, and it was a horrible disaster, and the train thing was a complete wreck. Okay. The nearby town of Hartford, Connecticut, had telephones installed. And all of the people, many of the people in the town who had telephones were medical doctors because they were rich. So a druggist who happened to have a telephone in his drugstore, which was kind of the Wi-Fi hotspot of the period, because he would like rent the telephone for people to come in. You could like pay at the drugstore and use the telephone service. He called all the doctors in town, and he called them all at once, not one at a time. He just called all of them. Terrible disaster in Tariffville. People are drowning and dying. They're freezing in the ice. So all the doctors in the town rushed out. They got on board a train. They took the 10 miles on the train, and they started hauling the drowning worshippers out of the ice on sleds. And this was the first time the telephone had ever proved some practical use. And after this, if you argued against telephones, people would say, but what about those women and children drowning and freezing in the ice? Are you trying to tell me that you prefer to have the women and children drowning and freezing in the ice? And this was an unanswerable argument. Of course you had to have a telephone in your town. What if your train has a terrible accident and your people are drowning and starving? Of course you want to go out and install a telephone. So they managed to install the telephone. And this disaster, I mean, really just a tremendous mess, accelerated the technological development of the telephone radically because it just demolished people's ability to resist it. And of course, the preacher the next day was still preaching. And he said to the survivors, this just proves that we, in the midst of life, we are in death, you know, and the Lord could take us away at any time. Because nobody ever says, you know, the lesson here is that you should not go to religious services. I mean, your mistake was to go and listen to God. You should have just stayed home and you wouldn't have drowned freezing in the ice. Nobody ever would frame it that way. On the contrary, people will always frame a disaster like that as something that was brought to us by God that we just have to like get in touch with, that we have to deal with, and so on. So there's a, you know, a great example of accidents involved in telephones. The first words that were ever said on the telephone, "Mr. Watson, come here, I need you." When Bell was yelling those words to his assistant in the other room, he had spilled acid on his trousers. A lot of people don't realize this, but he'd had a laboratory accident. He'd soiled his pants. And he simply yelled aloud because, you know, acid was biting into his legs. And he needed his assistant to come help him. And the guy happened to hear him in the other room because the telephone was turned on. But he didn't actually intend to say that. He had an accident and he was panicking. And they happened to hear that. And those were the first words ever sent across what became the telephone network. And those became very famous words. But they were the result of a laboratory accident rather than some kind of deliberate rhetorical effort. So, what happens if we go back in history? Is there a different kind of history where Alexander Graham Bell is a bizarre crank who doesn't think about anything except physics, and his physics don't work? And he's just maybe, you know, an inventor with a couple of very small successes and basically a lunatic. And Samuel Clemens sponsors a brilliant technological innovation, and he becomes a multimillionaire publisher, maybe a senator, a powerful, wealthy American industrialist. And people say, you know, this guy Clemens wrote a few amusing novels when he was young, but then he became an industrial titan, and he just made hundreds of millions of dollars, and he became one of the greatest, richest industrial robber barons of the American Gilded Age. The former novelist turned brilliant technical entrepreneur. And is there another version of history in which Thaddeus Cahill, instead of being a bankrupt guy whose musical machine failed totally, is there a world where he's seen as the precursor of all electronic music? There never was any recorded music. It was always in databases. It was always electronic. It was always streamed. Nobody ever invented the phonograph. There were no shellac records. There were no vinyl records. There were no CDs. It's just a world where recorded music was always streamed music. Music was something you got off a network. It was never something you bought. It was always a service from the first time you ever heard it. Is there another technological world where he was a prophet, where everything he said was correct? I really don't know. I just don't know. But I do think that we're into a technological period now where we're very into Cahillization, where we really like gadgets and gizmos more than we like successful objects. And how do we know if somebody is a failure or whether an invention is a mistake? The Sony Walkman lasted 30 years. It's just now been discontinued. If you find a Sony Walkman in another 30 years, no one will know what it is. It'll look something like this. It'll look something like this. Or it'll look something like that. Just like an odd device that like made plastic strips go by. So how do we know whether the Sony Walkman was a brilliant technological success, because obviously it was for a while, or whether in retrospect it's just some kind of bizarre freak device, a thing to like make noise come off of plastic tape, like a monster. And how many other similar devices have suffered the same fate as Cahill's machine? The fax machine, the vacuum tube analog television, the mini DV camera, the camcorder, desktop personal computers. I mean, everybody in this room knows about computers, obviously. Probably all have one. Imagine that somebody offered you a desktop personal computer with no internet connection. It just could not get on the net. There was no modem, there was no Wi-Fi, it was just a computer that belonged to you, and you could put any software you wanted on it, and you could like sit there and compute a word process, you know, maybe do some, I don't know, JPEG style stuff. But in order to get anything out of it, you had to print it out. So I had like a printer, you know, and maybe like a nice photographic printer too. It's just no connectivity, right? No net. It's a computer and it's personal and it's yours. And you can have it and it's like really, really very powerful. Would you bend over and pick it up? Would you touch the thing? Would you think about owning it for even a moment? And that's a personal computer, okay? I mean, we belong to a generation that's been saturated in propaganda for these devices. It's like my personal computer, okay, it's over. You don't really want one. Not if it's personal. Of course you don't want it if it's personal. You want it if it's networked, if it's social, if it's wireless. You don't want it if it's personal. It's just sort of over. So what was that? Was that a mistake? Was that a passing historical aberration? What do we call that? All we can know is that it's gone and we sort of didn't notice. Digital music players that aren't tied into a service somewhere. E-reading devices. GeoCities. MySpace. How much space in the MySpace? It's like, did that last as long as Cahill's machine even? Oh yeah, man, I had to have my own MySpace, but it's like dwindling now. It's like the horror of the, this is MySpace here. Where did it go? Oh yeah, that's MySpace. See all those spaces in there? Like lots of spaces. I mean, for a while it was thriving, and for a while it made somebody money. So we would call it a success, but you know, suppose it loses more money at the end than it made at the beginning. Then do you call it a success? Was it a terrible error? Was it just some kind of, was it an aberration? Was it an aberration? I mean, what are the worst mistakes we've made? They're all computer-assisted now. You can go look at a beautiful electronic letter system, mailing list, really. Risks to the public and computers and associated systems. I read it faithfully. It's had a big influence on my way of thinking. From the Association for Computing Machinery, risks to the public and computers and associated systems. It's just things that go wrong. Things like Jerome Kerviel. You know this guy, French embezzler, stole 80 million euros. How did a guy, a minor bank clerk, manage to steal such a huge sum of money, 80 million euros? Well, the secret was he didn't steal it for himself. He didn't actually steal it. He just kind of like misplaced it while hacking. Because he had the capacity to get a little deeper into the system. There was a flaw in there. Nobody had ever thought that anybody would mess with this because he couldn't really steal anything. All he could do was sort of mess with the bank's software. But he's an ingenious, bored guy. So he like just sort of gets into the machine and he decides to just start risking the bank's money. Okay, you know, 1 million euros, 8 million euros, 18 million euros. I'm like hacking, you know, it's like, this is cool. You know, it's like coming into work every day. It's like, man, I've got a secret life inside this machine. And like sometimes I win and then I have to figure out how to tell the bank that I won. And sometimes I lose and I have to conceal that I lost and eventually loses 80 million euros. And that's a little bit hard to hide, but it's all about software design. The guy's not even a thief. I mean, he is an embezzler, and he went to jail, and he should not have been doing this. What he was doing was culpable, but it's all about software design. You go and look at the BP explosion recently. Oil well breaks, United States Gulf of Mexico, massive oil spill during the height of the tourist season. There's black oil in Florida, black oil in Louisiana. Like, why didn't the alarms go off? Microsoft blue screen of death. They were running them under Windows. Like, well, you know, we had some kind of failure here, and it was like, we're just like oil well guys. What are we supposed to do about Microsoft? And, you know, and they know that there's nothing you could do. Because everybody's seen the Microsoft blue screen of death, and you can't successfully blame that for anything, ever. It's sort of written in the shrink wrap. Like, you know, my wife died because Windows crashed. Okay, you can't sue Windows for that. Because if they did, Windows wouldn't exist. I mean, the thing fails all the time, and there's no other method. The real estate collapse of financial instruments, especially in Florida. Computers were used to take the financial records of hundreds of thousands of homes, pile them together into real estate investment trusts, sell them off as financial instruments. People just lost the record. They don't actually know who legally owns what property. So they're just foreclosing things more or less at random. Just like taking people's homes away and hoping nobody protests. Really, without computers, it would be impossible to make that advance and also impossible to even try to save it. And these are things in which we live. I mean, this is the area in which we have somehow come to dwell, and it's just part of our lives. And so, you know, what's the ultimate motto here? Well, I think it's something about this guy. And this guy is Walter Benjamin's angel of history. I mean, if you're a Benjamin fan and kind of into futurity, there's this very famous Walter Benjamin quote where he talks about seeing a Paul Klee painting. And it's about the angel of futurity, who in a storm of history is blown backwards, blind into the future by this tremendous tempest of historical forces, which he can scarcely comprehend. And it's kind of it's basically a Marxist analysis. It's about historical determinism and how lost and weak we are in the hands of tremendous developments, fascism, communism, massive ideological upheavals, and so forth. And I didn't know until recently that this is what Walter Benjamin's Angel of History actually looks like. When Benjamin is describing the Angel of History, this is the guy he had in mind. And I like Klee pretty well, but this is not a particularly impressive figure. I mean, he's just sort of a cartoon. He's not really an angel. He's just a kind of construct. He's like somebody we made up in order to make our own story make sense. It's a kind of justification of history after the fact. Whereas history is not really like a tempest, I don't think. I think what this suggests, and what this suggests, is that history is something more like dirt. It's not wind, it's the soil. It's like ashes to ashes, dust to dust, and that's sort of the source of all fertility. Just kind of a deeply rooted, decaying, compost-like mess. It's not something that's aerial and angelic. History is something that's just earthy and more humane than that. And I hope that we could find a happier sense of coming to terms with our mistakes and errors, that we judge ourselves less harshly, that we try not to impose cartoon frameworks on the substance of history, just so we could talk about it in a more impressive way. I hope we could find some sympathy for error and a humane attachment to the people of the past, that we don't condemn this man as a failure because he was 100 years ahead of his time, that we don't condemn this man because he attempted to be something other than America's greatest novelist, and that we don't condemn this man because in some ways he was lucky to become a genius when he was basically just a lucky crank, a guy who would have made like a great electronic artist and not necessarily a major industrial figure, which is what he became later. I think that we put these men into positions they themselves would not have recognized. They respected one another more than we respect them. There's no question that Twain thought that Cahill was a genius. Of these three men here, Cahill was unquestionably the greatest technologist. He knew more about hardware. He knew more about electricity. He knew more about how to make real objects. He had a genuine doctorate. Bell never had a doctorate. Bell was a speech teacher. Twain was a steamboat captain and basically a wandering street Arab kind of guy, war deserter. But I think if we understand ourselves better, we could feel more of a sense of human warmth about the past. We can accept that our heroes have feet of clay, and we can also learn that our children, who seem to us to be rather dumb and ignorant because they're not well educated yet, they may well be much more important than us. They may be the people who really matter. I mean, they may be the people doing stuff of real consequence, and we should not be misled by our position in time. So, well, to sum it all up, it's kind of a blind whirlwind. It's just a whirlwind with more dirt in it. And at the end, it's like, well, there went another great vortex. There went another human story. That's sort of the end of it. It's like going to a really, really cool event where there was more going on than you could possibly understand. And you didn't know what really mattered, but boy, it was just great to be part of it happening, which is what I always feel at the end of Cher Festival. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Bruce.
What good fun.
There is any question? Qualche domanda? Nessuna domanda.
Oh, let's go get a drink. Come on.
Okay.